What I want to cover in the talk today is some material from my study and what I think may be the relevance of it to Spain. I got into my study because to deal with what I see as a basic paradox in the symphony world, and also, I might add, in some of the other performing arts. On the one hand, symphony music probably has never been performed more skillfully than it is currently performed, and yet we see that the finances of most symphony orchestras are very fragile. So in a nutshell, what I want to address today is why this is the case and what can be done about it. To start, I like to ask audiences to do a little reading. This is an April report from the New York Times. There we are. And would you just quickly read through it? Because there are three points in particular made in the article that I like. Now, the three points, to me, the three important points in the article, is first of all, the observation that symphonies are almost always in an operating deficit position. That is, the performance revenues that they earn from selling tickets to concerts, recording, broadcasting, essentially never cover their performance expenses. And as near as I can tell, this is true of about every symphony in the world. The second point that I like about it is it stresses the fact that because of this basic operating deficit, all symphonies, to balance their books, must rely on what I call non-performance income. That is income that comes from sources other than the sales of tickets and so on. And third, I always like to note the hopeful feeling expressed at the end of the quote. And unfortunately, that hope is forlorn. To see that, I must reveal another fact to you. I said this was an April article in the New York Times. I neglected to mention that the article appeared in April 1903, over a century ago. So almost from the beginning, at least in the United States, symphonies have been in a position of an operating deficit, and we'll see in a moment why that's the case, and had to somehow put together the difference between their operating revenues and usually excess operating expenses. What you confront now is not new, but some of the ways of dealing it have changed over time. I thought it might be useful if I start by quickly listing some of the main broad conclusions I have, and then go into the specifics of my study that resulted in this. As I just indicated, orchestras around the world face similar problems. No orchestra in the world earns enough from its performance revenues to cover expenses. Moreover, orchestras in most countries, certainly true in the United States, face declining concert attendance and face aging audiences. I will explain that there are three broad strategies that orchestras can use to try and deal with this financial jeopardy that they find themselves in. And my findings for the United States is none of these three strategies alone will cover the deficit. That is to say, none of these strategies alone will provide a permanent solution to orchestras. And in most of my talk, I'll explain why that's the case. I'm not sure whether this is true for other countries. It's an open question. Perhaps you have some feelings about that yourselves. And then finally, governments have radically different methods of supporting orchestras in the performing arts. And what I want to explain today is that the choice of model, whether you use a European subsidy model or take an approach that's closer to the US approach that I'll explain to you, which of those you choose means more than how you raise your money. There are some far-reaching consequences regarding decisions over the arts and what is supportable art that change depending on the method of government support. All right, how do I reach these conclusions? And again, I want to stress my study is of US data, and where I know I can extend it to other orchestras, I will say so. But to a certain extent, you all are going to have to do the work of deciding how much of this connects with what you see in your daily work. My study, I'm sorry, I should have clicked those as I went through them. Let me give you a chance to look at them before I move on to my study. Okay, my study, entitled A Perilous Life of Symphony Orchestras, deals with US data for 63 symphony orchestras. The data are reported by these organizations, these orchestras, each year to the League of American Orchestras, which is the US equivalent to the AEOS. They're very detailed questionnaires that the orchestras respond to, all sorts of details on their finances and on their operations. Each one of the 63 orchestras had been one of the largest 50 orchestras in the US for at least 2 years during the sample period. The sample, these 63 orchestras, represent 70% of the orchestra industry when you're measuring the industry by its budget size or by revenues, either way. The sample period, the period of my study, was the 1987 through 2005 concert seasons. I've already mentioned where the data came from. And in the study, what I tried to do is to consider the effect, first of all, of orchestra policies on the financial outcomes of orchestras. Secondly, the effect of the economic characteristics of the communities in which the orchestras operated. And thirdly, the effects, if any, of competition with other performing arts. In a practical sense, it was only competition with operas because they're the only art I could get sufficient data on to use in the study. Now, let's move to the basics. Probably the basic problem faced by symphony orchestras and virtually all other performing arts organizations, and as a matter of fact, for industries and certain parts of the public sector, is rooted in differences in productivity growth between the performing arts and goods-producing industries. And the one technical definition I'll give you today is labor productivity is output per employee. The issue is this. In goods-producing industries, technical change reduces the labor input, that is, increases labor productivity over time. We've all observed that in all sorts of manufacturing industries, for example. However, when we turn to the performing arts, there's limited potential for productivity growth. Composers and playwrights set the labor requirements for most important works, and for all practical purposes, those labor requirements are fixed for all time. So that within the performing arts, you can't think of sensibly productivity increasing from technical change. Now, I want to stress that lower productivity growth in the performing arts is nobody's fault. It's inherent in the nature of performance, where the performance and the performer are often one and the same person. Why is this lower productivity growth a problem? Well, the problem results from the fact that when we turn to the pay side of the picture, in goods-producing industries, over long periods of time, pay growth more or less follows productivity growth. And if pay is growing at the same rate as productivity growth, it means the increased pay to each person is covered by their increased output. So there's no increase in cost per unit of output over time. No need to increase prices over time. Now, when you turn to the performing arts, pay growth tends to follow pay growth in the goods producing sector, because if that were not the case, over time, pay between the goods producing sector and the arts producing sector would get wider and wider, and it would become more and more difficult to retain people in the performing arts sector. So over time, pay growth in the arts tends to follow pay growth in the goods producing sector. Since pay growth in the arts will not be offset by productivity growth, we already said the composers, playwrights, and so on fix the labor input. Output will not increase to match the increased pay, and cost per performance will increase continuously over time. This is what's known in the cultural economics trade as the cost disease. It affects virtually all low productivity growth increases. Ever-increasing costs mean an ever-increasing, and I stress those words, ever-increasing, upward pressure on ticket prices, and this is exactly what we see in the United States and other countries. Here's a picture for the United States over the period of my study. The top line there, which you may see is blue, is the cost of ticket prices. Expenses per ticket price per concert over time. I'm sorry, it's expenses per concert over time, to be precise, the cost of putting on each concert. The bottom line is something that's labeled the producer price index. Every country publishes this or has this. It's basically the cost of goods in the manufacturing sector as they leave the factory. And what you can see at a glance is the expense of concerts has grown in the US much more rapidly over the period shown than the costs of other goods in society. And when I ran similar numbers for other countries where I could get both data for both dimensions, the same pattern emerged. In every country, the expense of putting on concerts grew more rapidly than the producer price index. So this is something that symphonies and other arts organizations must live with. And once again, it's rooted in the differences in productivity growth between symphonies and the rest of the economy, and the fact that pay must more or less keep pace with pay developments in the private sector if the symphony sector is to retain its employees. All right. This cost disease is at the root of what, in the US at least, we call structural deficits faced by performing arts institutions. When performance revenues fail to keep up with and offset performance expenses in a fully employed economy, an orchestra has a structural deficit. I want to emphasize that. You'll see why in a moment. Structural deficits are the deficits that occur in a fully employed economy. Recessions add more difficulties, as you well know, and I'll come to that. So what the cost disease implies, and this is very insidious, is that orchestras and other performing arts organizations will face ever-growing expense increases. So finding the revenue, the reason I say it's insidious is that finding the revenues to cover this year's expenses does not prevent a deficit next year, even if you can get the same revenues in again, because the deficit is going to be larger. It's just inherent in the nature of the difference in productivity growth. So I like to say that the economic climate for symphony orchestras is ever-growing structural deficits. It's an implication, once again, of this cost disease. And when you turn to the data in the United States, in fact, you find that the fraction of performance expenses that are covered by performance revenues has declined over time. At this point, some casual observers of the arts rapidly jump to the conclusion, without thinking very hard, that society cannot afford the arts. But as a matter of logic, society can afford the arts if it so chooses. Why is this a matter of logic? Well, the answer is that real incomes in society rise with growing productivity. So all that productivity growth in the goods-producing sector provides the increased means, the increased real incomes, for society to afford more and more goods over time, including the performing arts. The issue facing the performing arts is not whether society can afford them, they can, through economic growth, but rather whether it chooses to afford them. The resources are there. The true question is, will they be directed toward performing arts expenses? Let me put that a different way. Even though the cost per concert keeps increasing more rapidly than the cost in the rest of society, the fact of the matter is real income growth in societies provides resources to support orchestras and other performing arts at the same rate if they choose to. The problem we face in the US, and I think some other countries face as well, is that not everyone chooses to. That there has been a declining demand for symphony music in the United States. To put it in basic terms, total attendance at US symphony concerts has been declining over time, even after you correct for recessions, cyclical influences, and so on. But it's also true that the demand has been declining for other performing arts. Every 5 years in the United States, a survey is taken of participation, attendance, if you will, in the performing arts. And what you see clearly in those surveys is that attendance in virtually all of the performing arts, I should say all of the performing arts except musical theater, has been declining. And I put out this fact to suggest that some of the problems that orchestras face may reach beyond the reach of orchestra policies. They may be due to broader social changes. In fact, one could go further. As I started to work on this book, I began to notice other peculiar facts that I would have otherwise ignored. Not only has demand been decreasing in the US for orchestras and other performing arts, but also for other traditional leisure time activities, fishing, hunting, golf, and so on. So this is very interesting, I think, and poorly understood, but what inevitably you focus on as being an orchestra-specific problem from the perspective of your own jobs. I understand you would focus on that as being an orchestra-specific problem. I just want to signal that there's other information out there that suggests it may be much broader than that. And one, to the extent it affects all the performing arts, it suggests that one might think about how the problem might be addressed by collaborations with other performing arts organizations. Rather than taking a competitive approach between different, these are big, I think, important questions for which no solutions have appeared to date. In fact, some of these trends are just being noticed. I wanted to show you a picture to reinforce my comment about declining demand in the United States. But there is a sense in which you don't have to see them. What you've got here is attendance per concert figures over the period of my study. And the only thing you have to notice is that almost all of these lines are sloping downward, unfortunately. The different lines represent different types of concerts given by the symphony orchestras in my sample. And again, the basic news, the unwelcome news, is that for virtually all of the major types of concerts, the attendance per concert has been going down over time. So this graph is just to back up the finding about the decline of demand in the United States. Well, with these deficits, and given the fact that increases in demand are not there to offset the effects of the cost disease, the ever-growing structural deficits require ever-growing non-performance income. Now, non-performance income, I think of as non-operating income. It's income you get from the government or from foundations, businesses, private individuals, basically donations, flows of income that are not tied to the presentation of a particular concert. As you probably know, in the United States, and I'll talk more about this in a moment, the flow of income from the government is very small. And in the United States, this raises a problem for the managers of orchestras, because there's no guarantee that the flow of income from private donations from individuals, foundations, and businesses will match the size of the deficit in any given year. So that orchestra managers in the US face substantial uncertainty on a year-to-year basis as to whether they'll be able to cover their deficit. As I said earlier, the fact that they managed to cover it in 1 year is no guarantee that they'll cover it the next year, because it depends entirely on whether the flow of private donations from these various sources is the same. And in fact, to signal the uncertainty that orchestras face, what we have in the United States is something that's virtually unknown in Europe, as far as I can determine, and that is orchestra bankruptcies, a very unwelcome fact of life. Over the period of my study, 43 orchestras averaged a deficit. That's over an 18-year period. 17 orchestras averaged a surplus. And the bad news, not represented on the chart here, is that over that 18-year period, there were 10 bankruptcies. Since 2005, when my study ended, particularly in the impact of the recession since 2009, there have been many more bankruptcies, some including very large symphonies. So this is the uncertain world that managers of US symphony orchestras face. And to gather terms here, I've been talking about initially a performance deficit, which is the difference between performance income and performance expenses. The total deficit reflects how successful or unsuccessful a symphony has been in covering the performance deficit with these outside funds, and that's all this definition reflects. So far, I haven't said much of anything about recessions. Cyclical deficits come about, as you know only too well, from recessions. If the structural deficit that I described, the deficit that you have at full employment due to the cost disease and the absence of demand, if you think of that as the the climate in which orchestras operate, recessions prevent a greater difficulty that I think of as bad weather. Within that overall climate, you have worse weather when there's a recession and better weather when you have full employment or more than that. The reasons are obvious. Recessions reduce the income of people. They're less likely to buy tickets. And in the US situation, they're less likely to make their normal donations. Indeed, most donations in the US come from people who actually attend the concerts. So every time you lose someone's attendance, you lose not only the ticket revenue, but some donation. The reason, of course, that recessions are bad for symphonies is that, again, in the US, it's a fact of life that revenues decline more rapidly in a recession than expenses do. And of course, this signals that one thing orchestras could do would be to try and make expenses more cyclically sensitive. Although that inevitably, as most policies involving changes in expenses, requires more conflict or involves more conflict. So first, people spend less money on tickets, and then the non-performance income declines just as the performance deficits get larger because people can are less able to afford the their normal donations. The only good thing you can say about cyclical deficits is that they're reversible, but they're reversible not by orchestra policies, but by government policies. The total deficit that an orchestra faces is the sum of the structural and cyclical deficit. What I like about the comparison is that it shows the difference that you can expect between a country where direct government subsidies almost don't exist, that would be the US, and in the case of Australia, a government with substantial government subsidies to orchestras. Incidentally, if we had a pie chart for the Spain, as you all know, the government subsidy slice would be 80%, not 37 and not 61. Now, basically what you see in the case of the US is that performance revenues are only 37% of total revenues. Everything else is what I'm referring to as non-performance revenue. We get almost nothing from the government, direct, you can see it's only 5%. 45% of total revenues come from annual private donations from three sources: businesses, individuals, foundations. There's also a slice that may seem strange to you called investment income. Investment income comes from endowments. Endowments are basically the funds set up by past private donations. The principal of the fund cannot be invaded generally, but an orchestra gets the benefit of the interest that's earned on investing the endowment. And in some orchestras, this has become significant, and you can see that that constitutes 13% of revenues. When you look at Australia, of course, you see huge government support, and the mirror image of that is very little private support. Investment income almost doesn't exist, and performance revenues are actually a smaller proportion of the total. I might add, for a few other countries where I was able to get data, you saw that same kind of pattern, in particular that the share of revenues for performance tended to be smaller than in the United States. Moving on to expenses, here's pie charts again for the US and Australia. 1 point I wanted to make is that in a country like the US, where managers cannot count on direct government subsidies, you don't get all the donations from individuals, businesses, and foundations without considerable effort, of course. So you see categories of expenses like fundraising and marketing that can be quite small, even trivial, in a country with substantial government support. Just compare them for the US and Australia to get the idea. It's also true that the difference you see between the share of artistic expenses in the pie is fairly characteristic of other countries that have government subsidies. That is, the US overall seems to have a fairly small share of expenses going to artistic expenses, in part because of the additional expenses it incurs in the pursuit of non-performance income, because it can't count on that normal flow from the government. All right, earlier when I mentioned in my main conclusions that there were three basic strategies, and none of them would work alone, I didn't say what the strategies were. This is just a matter of arithmetic. If you're trying to close your deficits, your performance deficits, or cover them, there are really only three broad strategies. The first is to raise performance revenue growth. The second is to reduce the growth of performance expenses. And the third is to increase the growth of non-performance income. And again, when I talk about non-performance income, the point that's quite important in thinking about different countries is to realize that it comes from a lot of different places. There's public or government support. And in the rest of my talk, I'm going to make a big distinction between direct government support, which I think most of you are familiar with, and what I'm going to call indirect government support, and explain further, which is the situation in the United States. Secondly, the second source of non-performance income growth is from private support, and then finally the investment income that I talked about when we looked at the pie chart. Now, what I said, or what you saw in the main conclusions, was of these three strategies, any one of them would help, but in the case of the United States, none of them alone would eliminate the deficit. And now I want to explain that statement. That is, I want to explain what the possibilities and limitations of each of these three broad strategies are, at least when looked at from the standpoint of the US data. I think that a lot of the points that are relevant in the US would resonate in other countries. All right, if we start with the first of these, raising performance income growth, this is largely a matter of building and retaining audiences and pricing tickets to increase revenues. Now, in the US, there are four challenges to pursuing this strategy. One I've already mentioned, which is declining overall attendance of its symphony concerts. And with this trend has been a decline in the proportion of proportion of subscription tickets sold. In other words, more and more of the audience, such as it is made up of people who buy a single ticket for that concert rather than subscribing to an entire season. For years, US orchestras added more and more concerts to their season, in part because they'd signed collective bargaining agreements guaranteeing musicians 52 weeks of work. And the evidence is quite strong that simply adding more and more concerts rapidly runs into diminishing returns. That is, as you add more and more concerts, the number of people attending each concert declines quite rapidly. Third, raising ticket prices to increase revenues always has some effect on attendance. In the analyses that I did, for example, a 10% increase in ticket prices would be accompanied on average by a 5% decline in attendance. Now, the problem is that if you raise your ticket prices by 10% and only lose 5% attendance, you might say, well, what's so bad about that? Total ticket revenues have increased. The problem is, as I mentioned earlier, that most of the donors to a symphony orchestra are the people who attend. So you lose not only the ticket revenue, but you also lose their donations. And that's the difficulty in simply trying to raise revenues by raising prices. I think in the case of the United States, there are far more possibilities for symphony orchestras if they worked more with changing the structure of ticket prices, charging more for the seats that were most desirable in the hall and less for the seats that were least desirable. Orchestras within the United States vary greatly in the number of different prices they have for different parts of their concert halls. And the Chicago Symphony, for example, was able to do a study of which seats were most favored by their patrons, and based on that study, altered their entire structure of ticket prices and raised revenues. The last point, the last challenge I would say to raising attendance is Again, in the US, the thought is usually, well, let's do a marketing study and let's have some more marketing activities. That can be helpful, but the evidence from my study is that marketing expenditures also encounter diminishing returns. So that as you pursue more and more marketing expense, you get smaller and smaller returns in terms of attendance. But to put the same point a different way, you can't forecast how additional marketing expenses are going to affect attendance from past experience. Now, the main limitation to the audience growth strategy in the United States, in a nutshell, is that even if the orchestras filled all their seats at their current ticket prices, they still would not cover their performance deficits. I actually did the computation for all of the orchestras in my study to check that. Now, I should start by saying, or should have started by saying, on average, US orchestras sell 70% of the seats in the house. So there's plenty of room to expand attendance. But how to do it? You can try the marketing expenditures. If you wanted to play with pricing, you might change the structure of prices, or you might reduce prices. My exercise, my arithmetical exercise, I think was quite optimistic. I said, take the existing number of empty seats and assume you could sell them at your current ticket prices. Would that cover your deficit? And the answer, unfortunately, was no. So filling the hall, the various exercises that symphonies go through to raise attendance will all help, but one should keep their eyes open. None of them will eliminate the performance deficit. The last point I'd make is a much more subtle one. Recall that when I was talking about the cost disease, the implication is the structural deficit will grow each year. Well, it's only so far that you can add to attendance. At some point, you're limited by the size of the hall. So again, it's well to realize that as much as even though expanding the audience can improve your finances, there are definite limits. Turning to the growth of expenses and policies to reduce that, this is the most conflictual strategy because it usually involves collective bargaining contracts and renegotiations of those contracts. And for that reason, historically, it's been the most avoided strategy in the United States. There is room for this strategy to be pursued. As you saw in the expense chart, artistic expenses, which are mainly musician salaries, constitute at least half of total expenses. In the US, musician salaries have increased more than the pay of other groups since the beginning of my study. I might add that for some European orchestras, I've been able to get salary data, and I can report that US musicians in real terms and adjusted for purchasing power earn higher salaries than European symphony musicians do and are at a higher point in our national income distribution. So at least in the case of the US, the old model of the starving musician probably is no longer appropriate. So there's room to cut back on the growth, and such negotiations are going on as we speak, and they are definitely conflictual. Right now, there are at least four major orchestras in which there are strikes or the workers are locked out, and as you heard earlier in a prior session, where the seasons have been canceled at least through the calendar year. The conflicts there, I think, is the symphony management sees it. It's an effort or an investment, if you will, to change people's expectations, employees' expectations about what's financially possible. There's a limitation, of course, to this strategy too. and that is, to the extent you're successful in slowing the growth rate of expenses, the risk eventually is that some people will leave for other sectors. Slowing the growth rate will unquestionably help an orchestra, but by itself is not a way to achieve permanent balance. Moving away from the salaries, just turning to the marketing expenses that are probably more relevant in the U.S. case than in many other cases, I would just say that they're diminishing returns to marketing expenses, and so again, in the context of the U.S., more attention to how far they should be carried would probably help some orchestras. All right, the third and final strategy is increasing non-performance income growth. Standard view, as I've said, is that the governments of other countries support orchestras more than the U.S. government does, and the view accurately describes differences in direct subsidies. On the other hand, indirect subsidies are much larger in the U.S. And indirect subsidies are what economists call tax expenditures, and the idea is this. If you spend your money in a certain way, you can deduct that expense from your taxable income. In a sense, it's money the government could have collected from you in taxes, but chooses not to collect from you if you spend it in a certain way. And that certain way that's relevant to orchestras is if you spend it to support most not-for-profit organizations in the United States, you can deduct it from taxable income. So donations to performing arts organizations fall under that rubric. And to give you an idea of how important this is, I computed that by 2005, this indirect support of the government, these tax expenditures, constituted 96% of the government support to U.S. orchestras. Only 4% came from direct subsidies, trivial as I said before, but the tax system, by foregoing certain taxes, if people spend their money in support of not-for-profit organizations, including arts organizations, that amounted to 96% of the government support. There are some broader implications of this tax expenditure approach that I'd like to point out. One is, it blurs the distinction between private and public support. Much of the private support for the U.S. that you saw in that pie chart came from donations that were stimulated by the tax code in the United States. So do you call them private, as I did in the pie chart, or do you call them public? The distinction becomes blurred. Probably more importantly is the fact that the system that the U.S. has of indirect support of the arts decentralized decisions about what constitutes supportable art. This also goes to comments that were made in this morning's session. Basically, instead of having arts elites decide how subsidies are directed, you have individuals, businesses, and foundations deciding where their art support is going to be targeted. And as Professor Munoz-Molina was arguing this morning, that decentralization of decision-making often encourages more innovation in the arts than a centralized system. And then finally, I'd stress, which is crucially important in the United States now, that the future of private support depends importantly on national tax policy. If a country tries to raise revenues, government revenues, as the U.S. certainly needs to do now, if they do it by raising tax rates, it's good for orchestras because it means the value of these deductions is greater. It encourages contributions. On the other hand, if they try and raise government revenue by broadening the tax break base and eliminating some of these tax expenditures, it could be worse for orchestras if the charitable deduction was narrowed. So right now, orchestras in the U.S. face considerable uncertainty until the government decides on its future tax policy as to what the future will bring them. Private support, I've already talked about the effect of government tax policies. Fundraising activities, you could see from the pie chart on expenses, are important for U.S. orchestras because they depend so much on private support. It is important in evaluating how far fundraising should be carried to evaluate what an incremental expenditure will bring rather than what the past will bring. Many of the donations to orchestras would occur even in the absence of a fundraising operation. In deciding how large a fundraising operation should be, you want to evaluate the incremental contribution against what it would cost. My own findings were that fundraising expenditures more than paid for themselves in larger U.S. orchestras, but I could find no reliable relationship between fundraising and the amount of donations smaller orchestras got. Characteristics of the local economy, not surprisingly, affect the level of donations. To some extent, orchestras have to live with the luck, good or bad, of where they're located. And then I also, as I mentioned, examined competition with operas. There were statistically significant but very small effects. That is, if you have an opera company in your locality that's also trying to raise funds, the impact on orchestra fundraising was quite small. So the limitations on non-performance income growth strategy is direct support from governments is now limited by efforts to reduce general government deficits. Indirect support may be limited by efforts to raise tax revenues, as I just said. There are limits to fundraising in an environment of declining attendance. And this is a U.S. statement. Private philanthropy seems increasingly concerned and focused on organizations addressing problems at the lower tail of the income distribution. And at least with current attendance demographics, orchestras and other arts seem to be at the other tail of the distribution. To summarize, the basic principles for deficit reduction that I come up with out of the United States is, first, recognize the difference between temporary reversible deficits from recessions, for example, and structural deficits. If you focus on structural deficits, I've tried to point out that there are three basic strategies and that none of the strategies by itself will cure structural deficits. As one observer put it to me, it looks as though orchestras must be good at everything, and I'm afraid that's true. And then finally, given the nature of the cost disease, permanent solutions for structural deficits must grow over time with the deficits. Many orchestra responses provide only a one-time gain, and the formula that balances this year's budget may not cover next year's larger structural deficit. So I'm going to leave it there. And when we get to questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about any aspect of this. Thank you very much.